drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. That lonesome train, I love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. Many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest.
It's Dave Monk, Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. This is February the 12th, 2017, and this is the Prairie Monk Show, your weekly look at the environment in East Central Illinois and as far as Dave wants to discuss.
So, this week has been interesting. I've just been listening to May Barenbaum on WILL. May Barenbaum is head of entomology, and a one-time wefty. She used to have an air shifter program, which was nits, gnats, and ninsects. And so today she's on CESU, which is a program that airs on WILL from 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock. And it's a sort of a comedy program, and with some intellectual asking of questions and competition. So May fits into those sorts of things very well. And she does a lot of public work, whether it be with pollination or with photography or with biochemistry. She has a group of interesting researchers and teachers who let us know about our ecosystem. I want to continue to introduce you to some references that help you understand your local ecosystem. I'm currently rather disappointed in what has happened with the Kickapoo Trail. It is tremendously wide, and it has taken out a huge amount of some of the best prairie soil and prairie plants that we have in this area. It's an area between Banner and St. Joe, and it has been used by the university for graduate student research and for demonstration to classes when the line was New York Central, and it's just tremendously sad to see the last little piece of prairie. We're down to 0.01%, and when you're down to that amount of remnant prairie, you don't go through and sculpt it out and remodel it and bring back a few reconstruction prairie plants. a little bit of it will be saved, but it's really very, very disappointing. And I hope like crazy that the next phase of this railbed from St. Joe to Ogden will not be as wide and not be as destructive of one of the world's most interesting ecosystems. It's very, very complex, and we need to save every little piece we can. Admittedly, it's disturbed. It has had road widening taken out of it. But I question the wisdom of taking out so many of our last little pieces of prairie restoration. To the point that I would think that the Forest Preserve is in charge in Champaign County. Champaign County was largely prairie. There are a few little forested places like the Big Grove and a few other riparian sites where the trees would have enough water to live on, but also enough drainage for them to survive. But basically, this was a very swampy prairie. And I've noticed that the museum that the Forest Preserve has, and it's a very healthy museum, has changed its name to include the word prairie. And I think it's time that we got out of the paradigm of a forest preserve, where even if it's only a name change only. So it's relatively easy to go in and preserve forested soil, forested riparian corridors where the terrain is awkward and you can't farm it anyway. And besides, people enjoy a tree more than they enjoy a prairie. Part of that is because they don't understand a prairie. So we have some responsibilities here, and I would suggest that the Forest Preserve should think about that and perhaps change its name to something that includes the prairie. We also have to look at the Grand Prairie Friends who put together, a lot of us put it together in order to provide us a focal point for prairie preservation. And it has currently morphed into forest, which again are much easier to deal with, and there's no prairies left. And how do we go about encouraging the Grand Prairie Friends to do what they were set out to do in the first place, which was to be a spokesperson for a preservation agency for prairie. So how do we help you preserve prairie? It comes in two categories. There's the one that we mostly settle on, which is the restoration of existing prairie. It invariably is not a real remnant prairie. It's usually disturbed. It's on a railroad line, which has had some disturbance. It's on old cemeteries that haven't been decimated with mowing and herbicide. We have these little places which are restoration prairies. And that is often weedy. It looks like weeds. It's hard. If you don't know your botany, you don't know the difference between the weed patch and a prairie patch. They are very different. The two books I'm looking at today, and I may not get to the second one. One is The Ecology and Management of Prairies in Central United States by Chris Helzer. He's with the Nature Conservancy, located in near to Lincoln, Nebraska, the east part of Nebraska. And he's speaking for people knowing about prairies. His book is oriented to letting farmers especially know what they have and what they might be able to work with. Many of these farmers have come from Europe and have had the luck to be able to buy land at a very low price and farm it and make quite a lot of money out of the ecosystem which gives them their wealth. We have quite a few farmers who realize that and are willing to have filter strips or plots of prairie on their farms that would remind us of our heritage. Those plots, often if they're a contour line, are very long and skinny. That's not always easy for ecosystems. If you have a bird located on that corridor, the bird is sensible enough to know that creatures can come in from either side. There's very little room for nesting. There's a very little room for hunting for food. So in some cases, we're looking for plots of land that are many acres. On the other end of this, there's the park districts and the forest preserves and the conservation districts that put in prairies. And there's a growing need. We're talking about May Birnbaum, but she is a leader in pollinatorium and pollination and the dependency we have on creatures that pollinate and winds that pollinate and how we can encourage this. So that's down to small plots, and some of those small plots are in urban situations where there is enough shade that a prairie that needs strong sunlight cannot deal with. If you take a blue stem plant that's out in the wilderness and transport it to a backyard 10 by 10, then you're going to make that plant an annual because it doesn't have enough heat and light from the climate to activate the adventitious buds that are on the block of grass that's under the top that usually dies in wintertime but comes back in the spring. So how do you take someone to weave a prairie and say, this is rather wonderful prairie. It's been a cornfield, but it's replacing, it's a reconstruction. How do you put plants near to a water course? How do you, so we've talked about Shirley, who got involved by helping to pick seed and then gradually got to know the these plants as friends and created a book. Even though she was a nurse, not a biologist, she learned the secrets of these plants, how they associate and how they have deep, deep roots there, whether those roots are tap roots or fibrous roots. And so I wanted to just look at this because Helzer is orienting his book to telling people what a prairie is, trying to annotate it, telling us what the ecology is, and then telling us a little bit about a restoration and what you can do. A bunch of this involves photography. If you can't get people out there, you take photographs of the flowers that are very small and short-lived often, and they have associates that may not even be recognized. So you can't lift this plant like a hoary puccoon and plant it somewhere else because you may not be taking its associates. There might be a fly or a bee, a tiny bee, not an Italian bee, but a whole slug of microbes there. So he defines a prairie as a tall prairie, a medium-sized prairie, or not a medium-sized, a medium-style prairie, and a short prairie. So you start with the rain shadow on the Rockies, and this prairie is short. And then you move through a somewhat taller prairie. Then eventually you get to Illinois and perhaps Indiana, but Wisconsin and Iowa and perhaps into Missouri, and through to Oklahoma and Texas, and those sites are tall, and they have been decimated more than other others because you have the eastern prairie was recognized, especially after drainage, it was recognized as very valuable farmland. So it's been dug up to the extent that every little corner has gone. In some cases, we're very lucky. A railroad would go through a corner, and there was a triangle of prairie that might be a quarter of an acre that has perhaps 50 or more species on it. It was small enough that you couldn't take a team of horses and a plow and plow it up for crops or put a livestock on it. And so it's gotten preserved as one of those west of Kankakee. It's called the English Prairie. And it will boggle your mind if you stand on the side or if you walk into it. If you walk into it, you're tippy-toe because every time you put your foot down, you put your foot on a prairie plant. For those of us who have been bitten by the bug, that's quite an experience. And so that sort of remnant prairie gets preserved by the state and by the nation and by not-for-profit conservancy groups that are willing to go to such a site and sometimes fence it like a cemetery. And put money into making signs so people actually know what it's about. Sometimes we don't even put up a sign because it might indicate that this is a place that should be challenged because it does look like weeds. And that little prairie has a structure. It has some plants that are 10 feet tall with 10 or 12 feet roots that are tap roots. Interspersed with little blue stem that might have a mile of fibrous roots. And in between are the very subtle niches where you can have a fly or a beetle or a pollinator. And we're very early in our study of prairies. We don't know very much about them. We got rid of them before we knew what we were about. It's not unusual. All around the world, we're losing ecosystems, very complex ecosystems, to the human desire to produce more food and feed more humans. And I'm sorry, but I am in favor of humans having the common sense to not overpopulate and overcarry themselves on native ecosystems, which in turn they're a part of. And we don't always fit. So some of these references that I've been running through are an attempt to help you to understand what your ecosystem is, and to perhaps even suggest that you might end up studying this sort of thing. This last week, I've had three high school people come to work on the little pocket prairie across the road. And one of them has been asking me if I could be a reference for her wanting to be in a summer institute or a workshop where she is involved in environmental studies. And she says that she was there because by happenstance she came to work with the Pocket Prairie and was impressed by that and has actually chosen that as a field. So it's important to have these little plots around and know about them. So yes, we can help that. And the universities can also help with things like master naturalist programs where you start to look at things. So we look at a prairie in a very broad sense, so that in the Midwest you have tall grass prairies to the east and short grass prairies to the west, and they're very different. They have basic species that are the same, but some species will cut out as you go north, some species will thrive as they go south and have a higher temperature. We can also sort out the prairie according to whether it's a cold species or a warm species. Cold species like Canada wild rye and a few others come into action very shortly after the spring. Many of the liliaceous star plants, the starry-eyed grass, come early in the spring. You hardly even notice them, and they tail off in summer and come back in the fall. In the middle, you have the form, the warm grass species, and that is when you get the big blue stems and the Indian grasses and the switch grasses and the little blue stems. And it is often mostly grasses. Perhaps 70% of a prairie was grasses. But the definition of a prairie is that it has a whole bunch of broadleaf plants in there. It's not just grasses. And we didn't always understand that, because you see the grasses and you think that the grass is waving in the wind. As the wind ruffles across the prairie, you're impressed by that sort of movement. But underneath there, where there's room, there are broadleaf species. So you can define a prairie by its warm season and cool season species. It was a bother to early settlers to have most of the biomass growing as warm grasses, because they were wanting to have cattle and row crops that would start early in the spring. They were cultivars that would give hay and food for animals early in the spring. So that's why we have prairies that are largely, the weeds we have are cultivar plants often, like sweet clover, because we have this desire for food in the early spring and in the fall. So that's another way of looking at a prairie, is to look at it as cool or warm season species. And the warm species are the ones that are most of the biodiversity and also the biomass. Some of the other plants are sometimes more delicate. Then you can look at a prairie as part of a disturbance. If you go to a place like southern Illinois, where sometimes people have farmed into the Shawnee Forest, then you'll have a plot of land that was not all that productive, because it may not have been glaciated the same way as we have had our soils locally glaciated with rich materials from the Laurentian Shield. And some of those plots of land are vacated. And if you look at those plots of land, you'll see that certain species grow at certain times. So if you see a field with I'm trying to think of the name. It's a small composite, and it's all white, and that's an indication that this is a field that's 1 year old. If you see a lot of New England aster, then it might be 3 years old, or it might have been a plant that enjoys the soil that has been disturbed before. If it's about 4 years old, it might have a prairie plant called gray-headed coneflower or yellow coneflower, which is dominant. But it's only dominant for a few years. It then balances out, especially if you overseed it with other prairie plants. So that's a third way of looking at a prairie, is to look at the degree of disturbance. You can see it. Daisy fleabane is the 1 year old plant that I was trying to think of. And if you can see daisy fleabane, there'll always be a daisy fleabane around in your prairie, even if it's mature, because there will be gophers and little places where there's disturbance and perhaps urination and the richness there that will have a daisy fleabane. But if you see a whole field of daisy fleabane, then that is an indication that that area has been disturbed. Sometimes you'll look at a railroad line that has been herbicided, and Curtis Cand here or spiderwort will be there, and that just happens to be a plant that can handle that sort of disturbance and come back in. So prairie people look at the degree of disturbance and the amount of original plants that are there. If you are really interested, you can go in with a square, and you can read that prairie and figure out, take a transect, perhaps along a railroad line, and statistically you can throw a 1 yard square, and then you count the plants, and then you have to be sophisticated enough to know that if you count one plant with very big leaves, does that equal 10 little plants that you can hardly see? So that's giving you an indication of what you've got and what you might be able to deal with. So a farmer may have a corner that couldn't be dug up with horses, but unfortunately now you can back up a huge tractor and take that little corner out, and that's happening. But we would beg farmers not to do that, but to keep this little piece of heritage together. Then how do we teach people what they have and how to be excited about what they have and how to augment it and how to buy seed that can be placed there? Where do you get the seed from? Hopefully you're going to try and establish this prairie as something that was when early settlement occurred. You hope that there are areas nearby, like we have a prairie north of Rantoul, which is adjacent to an old road, to an old interurban line, and to a mainline Canadian National Railroad. And those are all areas that have been disturbed in a linear fashion, but there's green prairie on the right of way on either side of those the lines of communication. It's not God's greatest prairie because it's one of those thin strips that you know are not good for a bird or a bee or a small mammal or even a buffalo. Can you imagine a turkey vulture that needs perhaps even thousands of acres of ground to search for carrion or dead creatures, an owl or an eagle or a buffalo? Those creatures have disappeared and cannot come back again unless you have sites that will support that degree of balance, so that one species can perhaps take a disease and die, but there will be another to take over. There's this dynamics. But you do know that some of those species you can pick and seed, and we have an adjacent gravel pit that has good original glacial till, and you can do regrowth succession. You have to be wary that you don't get one species that takes over. We have one corner of that prairie that has become a prairie dock field, and other places there are compost plants that have taken over. So you have to be very imaginative as to how you come back. So if you're going to buy seed, you have to know that seed has come from a local situation near to yours. The Prairie Moon Nursery and other nurseries buy seed. We sell seed to Prairie Moon, and we document where it's from. And if they sell that seed back to you as a farmer or as a roadside developer, you're going to get seed that's somewhat like your ecosystem. They will probably try to work out whether you're a specialist in prairie and are very concerned about this, or whether you're sort of planting a roadside and recreating a few species that may look like a prairie but really don't have a range of the 100 species that could be there, because there's herbicide and there's constant mowing. So in the case of a roadside situation, if it is known to be a special plot that has special characteristics and you're upgrading it, then they will sell to you within 50 miles of where the seed was picked. But if it's a more general thing, it's something in the median strip of a road, then you're doing rough and tough stuff, and you can have seed that comes from 100 miles circumference, or not quite so near. A compass plant is a compass plant after all, and you don't have to have it adapted to the local scene. That means that you have to have companies out there that gather up seed and don't just sell it as wildflower seed with a few interesting plants from Texas or somewhere else that might not be quite what the prairie was like, and you know it. So when we look at the Kickapoo Trail, one of the questions we have right now is, who is buying the seed for the next phase of development? Who is asking the state where they're getting the seed from? Does this come from Oregon or somewhere else? Is it seed that is bundled in special little groups so that you have associates, so that you can go to a high spot and plant creatures that are in a site that is windblown and has loess on it, and it gets very dry when it's dry and very wet when it's wet. So where does the seed come from? And you don't always know. The state puts down a list of prairie that it can plant as a prairie planting, and you have to be very persistent to find out where that seed is coming from and who gets it. Are there weed seeds in this seed? Are there the wrong associates? So we work with Prairie Moon because it does very well. There are other agencies that also do this. But when you come to 10,000 acres, if you're lucky enough to go to the Kankakee Sands and put in a huge prairie, then you're going to have to plant that mechanically. So then do you create mixers that are according to the terrain, according to the riparian areas? Where do you put your rushes and your junkers? And in to do that, you have to have mechanics and equipment where you dump mixed seed in. Now, that's not too bad, because give it 1,000 years and these creatures will sort themselves out. So if you have seeded something in a pond where it doesn't belong, it will die off, and some other creature will take over. it will restore itself. And in the meantime, it looks just like a prairie. And it also acts like a prairie. So if you have a snake or an ant or an insect, a grasshopper or a bird like a Hensley sparrow or a small mammal, they will start to use this prairie and they will start to move seed around. But if you know your territory and you know your terrain and you know that you want something that's along the lines of a wetland in wet places, then you sort that seed out accordingly and you work with seed providers to do that. Yeah. As you go along the Kickapoo Trail, every so often you have a drain and a wetland. And so do we plant the corridor to a general mix and let it sort itself out? Or do you plant according to your study of the situation? And do you broadcast, which is you need more seed because some of it's not going to land in the right place, some of it's going to get eaten by a meadow vole or other creatures. We're very, very lucky at near to St. Joe, the railroad line separates from the road. There's an adjacent road which is very small, but the prairie there has not been disturbed, and since it has not been mowed recently, it's coming out of the woodwork, and these creatures are there. So you don't even have to see it in that sort of situation. But if you wanted a purple gentian or a baptisia, then you might want to seed that in, and even if you know you're going to have deer and other creatures that are going to eat your small plant because it's nice and juicy, then you have to have a greenhouse somewhere where you grow that creature till it's big enough to be able to protect itself and not be eaten out of existence. So the Natural History Survey has greenhouses like this, and the Grand Prairie Friends has a sale each year of plants that it has grown from seed and then potted in small pots, and they're mature enough that if you're careful, you can grow them, and they will be inspiration to you and the people that you introduce them to. It's costly to do that. You have to have a soil mix that simulates what a prairie soil is. You have to have people who pot those plants, and you have to have them watered over and over again for many weeks. And then if you're wise, you have a plot and you put fence around it, because a rabbit, when it's very small, can go through a one-inch hole, so you have to have netting that's small, and you could put that around and allow it to the plants therein to grow. Rather nice, but it's not the sort of thing that is very friendly for creatures that are going to use the prairie, especially if you're walking dogs or. And if you watch a dog, you have to know that creatures also like their prairie. David has a little video of a dog that jumps up and through the prairie, and it's partially because the dog needs to see above the grass.
I actually knew a dog that did that in fields, as he would run through with them in the early corn or something like that, maybe soybeans if he was short enough. But yes, he would jump to, you'd see, just suddenly see this head come up over the top so he could see where you were, and then he'd disappear again. I have to say, I don't know exactly where that video is. If I can find it and we have the rights to it, we can drop that into the video of this episode so anyone who tunes in can see the hopping dog.
But sometimes it's not even to see. It's because they're excited and they're barking, and that for some people is a problem. But the, especially if there's one or two dogs and they're chasing each other and they're having games, that they love this sort of prairie. If you have an animal like a cow, the cows will enjoy just the release from having a regular field. If you have a friendly goat, you have to watch, because the friendly goat will eat anything and everything. You have to then have little fences that allow you to move the goat across from one field to another so it doesn't get eaten out. But goats also enjoy the prairie, and they can be very, very friendly. Sometimes people are wanting to use goats to work with invasive species, and that's another question. You have to look at your prairie and look at the species that don't belong, and how do you get rid of them? And one way of getting rid of a plot of say Canada thistle, or is to put a fence around it and leave it to the goats to eat. It's not awfully friendly to the goats, I think, because it doesn't give them the biodiversity that you want. But it certainly can reduce an invasive plot that you can control. And that avoids the use of herbicides, which is almost a tool of trade for conservationists, because it is so hard to get rid of trees and like autumn olives and the like. And then you have to think about the bacteria and the fungi that are in there, what is in the soil itself, and we have to know that we've decimated those millions and millions of bacteria and fungi in order to grow row crops and to fertilize them and to herbicide them. So a message to the farmer is to not fertilize and not herbicide this area, except if you're going to do something specific with an invasive creature.
Do you have time for a question here? I've been thinking about this since you mentioned how we've gotten down to a fraction of 1% of the original prairie that was here, and how people didn't think not to do that back at the beginning. Given what you know about human nature, it's pretty fanciful to think that anyone back then could possibly have stepped forward and said, no, wait a second, Sal, you better not, you know, turn all of this into cropland. We're going to need to preserve, you know, maybe 10% of this. It's just people were never going to think that way. You can answer that question. And also, what would you say to current farmers to try and get them to set a little bit aside, say, okay, it's too late to, it would be there is no remnant prairie anymore, but could you please set it a little bit aside so that it can be reclaimed as a regrowth prairie?
The last question is sustainability. Is asking someone to make a contour. It would be a thin strip, but it which is not so effective as a square or a large plot, but it's still something, and you have to know that equipment has to move through and over that contour. It's very, very hard to do. The other set-aside is left to people like Teddy Roosevelt, who went out west and saw things, or Muir, who went to the major parks that are out there. There are things like wolves that you might want to preserve. You might want to reintroduce them. So you in Yosemite,
that sort of thing has happened, and that creates a balance so that you don't have an overdose of deer and elk and buffalo. You have natural predators, and that means that certain areas are not occupied by those animals because that might be more dangerous. So perhaps a riparian area might come back with a different vegetation because no longer is it being eaten out by a mammal. We have ants and creatures that independently very, very light, but when you add them up per acre, they're massive creatures, massive biodiversity. We have in just our little prairie across the road aphids, and you can see the ants going up to the aphids, and they stroke their anal cerci and get a drop of glucose out of those. And sometimes they take those aphids down into their nests and they treat them as pets, and they will stroke their anal cerci for glucose. Ants are sugar junkies. And then there are grasshoppers and places like Yellowstone have grasshoppers, and then you have birds, and in places like Yellowstone, we'll have enough room for a turkey vulture or an eagle or nesting birds that like to nest in prairies low on the ground. And so we need more research sites like that. I've been raving on, but I was going to say a little bit about some of our local sites. If you go to Meadowbrook Park, one of the early things that prairie restoration people did was they looked at grasses and they grew grasses. So you can go to Meadowbrook Park and you can see where some of us were involved in planting grasses early on before we knew much better. We planted into it. We put in compass plants and dhaka that you can see here and there. But then Audubon came along, and Audubon went collecting seed. And to some extent, this was a seeding that goes with academic years. And if you're not careful, you can have a September prairie or an October prairie because you're picking seed at that time. Whereas if you want real biodiversity, you try to find the plants that come at a different time of the year. If you're looking at starry-eyed grass, you have to be down on your belly and you have to put in little flags. And by the time the seed has gotten ripe, the other grasses have grown around it and you can't find it. So it's the devil's own job to try and get that seed. So it ain't always easy. But at Meadowbrook Park, as you go up the hill, the prairie is much more rich. And then at the top of the hill, there's a gazebo where you can actually look out over the prairie and see some of these things. And you can see the little creek coming down. It's the upper reach of the Ombra. There are trees on it. And at some stage, somebody decided to remove the trees to let the water go faster. And there was a riot because those trees were where birds would live. Occipitus would sit in the top of a branch and rip off a snake or a meadow vole. And then there were beavers. And the beavers create a dam, and the dam creates a wetland and creates a different ecology. So there was all happening on Meadowbrook Park, which was a farm with a farmhouse and farm buildings. And there also is the horticultural club with plants that sometimes are lifted straight out of the prairie and adapted and
made with flowers that are larger and more like a purple cornflower or echinacea, might be more purple, and the petals are stronger than the wimpy pale purple cornflower, and they flower for longer. So researchers spend time taking the prairie plants and adapting them. If we go to a railroad bed, we sometimes, at near to Allerton Park, we have autumn olive trees. And if you leave the autumn olive trees as invasive plants around too long, you change the pH of the soil, and you change all those microorganisms in the soil, and you lose your prairie. You can take it back by chainsawing the trees out and herbiciding the stump, but it's going to sometimes have shoots, like Canada thistle has underground rhizomes, so it's the devil own to get rid of it. And people who are doing organic farming and have Canada thistle are in strife, because how do you get rid of Canada thistle when it has mechanisms that are very supportive of their survival? They take off all the heads so there's no seeds to blow around. That's the first thing to do. But to get those rhizomes out is difficult. Sometimes you can plant at Allerton, owned by the university. Work with Fran Hardy, who is a nature conservancy person. They've organized a mile of prairie 66 feet wide, taken out of the adjacent cornfield. So you put in 12 species, three-year-old plants, so they can survive, and you plant seed in some of the graminaceous things, the grasses, and you have a balance, and after 7 years, that prairie is starting to look like a prairie, and you can augment it with other plantings if you want. Then you have to consider, how do you allow people to have access to these places? Can they walk through it? Do they walk through it in an alligator line and make a trail? And then when you make a trail, you have an edge timber effect. You have creatures like ragweed that grow because there's a disturbance, and your prairie gets smaller and smaller. So sometimes you don't have a trail. You get your people to move through independently so that they're like a buffalo walking across the prairie. And so then we would like to make that section of 4 miles of railroad right away, abandoned prairie, a nature trail. So it wasn't like the Kickapoo Trail, 20 foot wide. It's perhaps a 2 feet wide trail, and perhaps taken in one direction, so no bicycle would have to pass a bicycle. You might even make it a walking-only trail. So people can stop and smell the roses. And there are prairie roses, and there are prairie snakes, and you can enjoy. I see it's nearly time. But the book that I have... recommending is The Ecology and Management of Prairies in the Central United States. And next week I'll probably come back with this again, because there's a guide to prairie restoration, and this is by Darrell Smith and a bunch of others, and they have a guide that is somewhat more sophisticated. In order to study this, you probably need a biology degree. They don't use scientific names, but there's enough information here
and it's associated with a prairie center, and there's a gob of information there that could be very helpful if you're interested in professional aspects of prairie restoration of an existing prairie, or reconstruction where you're on a cornfield or something where there is no prairie plants to start with. So this is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your